With almost 2 weeks to go before the first ballots are cast in Texas for the general election, a court decision that could change the rules for voters, the story today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.
I'm David Brown. A federal court tosses new rules against straight ticket voting. The state attorney general plans an appeal. We'll hear what the impact could be for Texas voters. Governor Abbott's not on the ballot, but in a special election set for tomorrow. His pandemic policies are front and center, exposing a deepening rift among Republicans. We'll hear why. Also, a rare voice on radio marks a golden anniversary. The Texas-based In Black America and more when the Texas Standard gets underway. And that happens right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard Time on this 28th day of September 2020. Hope your Monday's been a good one so far. I'm David Brown. Amid the flurry of news over the weekend, here's an item you might have missed. And if you plan to cast a ballot when early voting in the general election starts 15 days from now, this one could well affect you. Late Friday, a federal judge blocked the implementation of a change signed into law almost 3 years ago, one that eliminates what's called straight ticket voting. For many years in Texas, voters could vote for all the candidates of either one party or another in a general election by choosing a straight ticket option at the top of the ballot. Though most states don't allow straight ticket balloting in general elections, Democratic lawmakers at the time pushed back on the change, fearing that there would be voter drop-off if it were harder to work your way down a full slate of candidates one by one. As the Texas Tribune noted, in Harris County, for example, ballots can go on for page after page after page because of the number of state district judges and other local officials running for office. In the last general election in 2018, roughly two-thirds of all voters statewide used the straight ticket option. Now, that option was to disappear this year, but a federal judge has now sided with Texas Democrats suing to allow straight ticket voting. And the Texas Attorney General is vowing an appeal. Steve Vladek is the Charles Allen Wright Chair in Federal Courts at the University of Texas School of Law. His area of expertise includes federal courts and constitutional law. Professor Vladek, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Thanks, David. Always great to be with you.
Great to have you with us. So the federal judge blocking the elimination of the straight ticket voting, the judge citing the current coronavirus pandemic. What's the rationale here?
Yeah, I mean, the basic rationale further to your description is that without straight ticket voting, what tends to happen is it takes voters longer to vote. And especially in jurisdictions like Harris County, like Travis County, like Dallas and Tarrant County, where you have so many races on the ballot, that inevitably leads to longer lines at the polling places because it takes the average voter five, six, seven times as long to vote. And that tends to be in Democratic jurisdictions, especially as the Texas Tribune has reported. So Judge Marmolejo basically said, especially given the public health concerns that arise from having people in the same indoor spaces for such a long period of time, that justified putting implementation of this law on hold until after the November elections.
I want to ask you about an aspect of the judge's decision that was sort of compounded, or as Judge Marmolejo sees it, compounded the injury. She found that the law would impose a discriminatory burden on Black and Hispanic voters. What is the thinking behind that rationale?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thinking is that demographic patterns being what they are, Black and Hispanic voters throughout Texas are actually concentrated into those jurisdictions with the longest ballots, and therefore they're concentrated into those jurisdictions where doing away with single ticket voting is going to have the greatest impact on how long it takes the individual voter to vote in person, and therefore the lines we might expect at individual polling places. You know, I think that that's sort of true in general, David, but in the broader context of the COVID pandemic, it's a specific reason why that actually causes injury to these voters above and beyond just having to wait in line for longer.
Well, Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton over the weekend filed a motion to try to stay the judge's order and also announced plans to appeal the decision. But the clock is ticking. I mean, here we are almost 2 weeks away, and we have ballots that are printed, at least in conformity with the law, at least as it was understood before Friday. Where do we stand with all of this?
Yeah, I mean, I think for the moment, you know, we stand in a bit of chaos, and I think that's going to be one of the strongest arguments that the state has when it goes to the Fifth Circuit, the Federal Appeals Court. I think it's likely, David, just as a general proposition, but especially on the facts of this case, that the Fifth Circuit does issue a stay of Judge Marmolejo's order, and that however long it takes for this issue to be appealed, you know, we're not going to see single-ticket voting on the ballot when voting starts in just a couple weeks. So I think it's easy to be sympathetic to Judge Marmolejo's decision. I think it's unlikely that decision's still going to be on the books when Texans start going to the polls.
And you say that because of the practical considerations here, having to reprint ballots and all that sort of thing?
So I think the practical considerations are part of it. I mean, the Supreme Court of the United States has stressed for years that it is deeply skeptical of judicial decisions that change the rules on the eve of elections. But I also think the politics here are part of it as well. I mean, the Fifth Circuit, as I think folks know, is a very conservative appellate court. It's one that tends to be incredibly deferential to states when it comes to these kinds of voting and election challenges. Both of those pressures, both of those tendencies swim in the same direction here, which is a likely stay of Judge Marmolejo's order while the case is appealed, which for practical matters means we will not have straight ticket voting across Texas, you know, when voting starts in a couple weeks.
So briefly, if you're a voter, you need to bone up on what's happening in your local elections right now.
That's right. And, you know, folks should understand that there's plenty of information available. At least many jurisdictions in the state provide sample ballots online, so you can do some prep work in advance. But also, I mean, I think the real bottom line here is for folks who are planning to vote in person, you know, avail yourselves of early voting opportunities whenever and wherever you can, because without single ticket voting, it's going to take every single person who goes to the polls longer to fill in their ballot. It means we're going to see longer lines during early voting and especially on election day.
Steve Vladeck is a professor of law at University of Texas School of Law. Professor, thanks again.
Anytime.
Well, a special election for a state Senate seat happening tomorrow is exposing more of an intra-party rift for Texas Republicans. Here to talk about that, Patrick Svitek. He's been following this race for the Texas Tribune, where he is primary political correspondent. Patrick, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me on.
You begin your story for the Texas Tribune by saying Governor Greg Abbott may not be on the ballot this fall, but his response to the coronavirus pandemic is reverberating through this special election for a Texas Senate seat. Who's on the ballot, and what does this have to do with the coronavirus pandemic?
Yeah, you've got a six-way special election. You've got five Republicans, and the top two Republicans, among them, one of the big debates in this race is Abbott's handling of the coronavirus pandemic, namely the shutdown of businesses. Obviously, Abbott had issued a stay-at-home order in April that, you know, led to a lot of businesses being shut down. And even though he's reopened many businesses since then, you still have bars that don't serve food, for example, you know, completely shut down. And among some conservative activists and people on the hard right, Abbott has just, you know, not done enough to reopen the state. And they believe that he's kind of been too sensitive to public health concerns and not sensitive enough to concerns about kind of restoring people's livelihoods. And so you have the top two candidates in this race really going after that. You have Shelley Luther, who is the Dallas salon owner who refused to shut down her business earlier this year due to those restrictions. And then you have State Rep Drew Springer of Munster. There's really been a debate between them about how much you agree with Abbott's response to the pandemic. And Luther, I would say, has been a little more of a forceful critic of Abbott.
What about Governor Abbott or Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick? Have they weighed in on this race at all?
They have not formally. No, Abbott's campaign did not respond to requests for comment. He hasn't endorsed in the race, and he hasn't, you know, offered any kind of commentary on it. In an interview with the Dallas Morning News, I think last month, the Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick said he was going to stay out of it, but he did kind of say that he had a bit of an affinity for, you know, Luther and her kind of unconventional story, and likened it to his, you know, initial rise to the state Senate years ago when he was a DJ in Houston who was not given much of a chance. But long story short, neither of them have endorsed in this race, and it seems like for the most part trying to stay out of it.
Well, Shelley Luther is a bit of a political unknown. Is this her first race, and is she primarily focusing on the pandemic? I mean, is that the centerpiece of her candidacy?
Yeah, I mean, her willingness to stand up and fight against those restrictions, that is certainly a centerpiece of her campaign. And she's also running as just an unabashed political outsider. She was not very involved in politics before this. You know, one of the attacks on her right now is that she just can't be trusted. She never voted in a Republican primary before, for example. And she's almost kind of embraced those attacks because they allow her to further brandish this idea that she is a true political outsider. And so those attacks haven't necessarily given her any heartburn, I think.
For those who haven't been following Texas politics very closely, when they hear about how this sort of underscores intra-party rifts, what intra-party rifts? I think I heard something about a lawsuit recently involving some prominent Texas Republicans against Governor Abbott.
Right. You know, throughout this pandemic, you know, the crowd of people within Abbott's own party who've been critical of him, you know, has, I think, grown in significant ways. At first, it was kind of the usual people who are willing to speak up and criticize other members of their party. But now you have, in one example I point in the story, you have a new chairman of the state Republican Party, Alan West, who was elected in July and has not been afraid at all to voice disagreement with some of Abbott's decisions during this pandemic. He said that he opposes the statewide mask mandate that Abbott put into effect. And then, as you just alluded to, he recently joined a lawsuit to stop Abbott's extension of the early voting period for the November election, saying that we need to have a special session. The legislature needs to be consulted before a decision like that is made. So there's increasingly, I'd say, rambunctious and outspoken wing of Abbott's party that is willing to stand up to him on some of this stuff.
Patrick Svitek is a primary political correspondent for the Texas Tribune. We'll link to his latest at texasstandard.org. Patrick, thanks again.
Thanks so much.
Social media editor Wells Dunbar is monitoring what Texans are talking about on this Monday. Hello, Wells.
Hi, David. Hearing from folks about the story at the top of the show, the judge's intervention calling for a return to straight ticket voting, citing the threat of the coronavirus there. Lots of folks chiming in about this one on our Facebook page. Murphy McBride says you should be able to vote a straight ticket. Such unnecessary meddling by the state, they say. I wish we could stop mucking up a good process. Voting in Texas is safe and secure. Meanwhile, echoing some of those concerns we heard earlier, Randall Munro says, I'm a bit leery of voting changes being made this late in the game. And Christopher Bart says, I was always surprised Republicans did this in the first place because I figured they benefited from straight ticket voting as much as anybody else. I would often use the straight ticket option, but it didn't save any time as I still went through the entire ballot to verify everything. You know, I've kind of wondered that myself because I'd go back and double check everything too. Those are just some of the responses we're seeing out there on this and other stories. I'll be back with more later in the show, David.
What's on your news radar, Texas? Reach out to us. Just look for Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice. Wells Dunbar back with more of your comments in 35.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, dedicated to the fight against cancer through telemedicine, providing patients with the ability to conduct online virtual appointments. More at texasoncology.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from White Mountain Bulgarian Yogurt, family-owned and operated in Austin, Texas for 40 years. Learn about the value of eating traditional Bulgarian yogurt at whitemountainfoods.com, available in the dairy aisle.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Across the Lone Star State, communities are holding celebrations and events in conjunction with Hispanic Heritage Month. And here on the Standard, we're hearing the stories and voices of several Latino trailblazers. Today, Houston Public Media's Elizabeth Trovall reports on the story of Johnny Mata, who for decades has fought against police brutality in Houston's communities of color.
More than 40 years ago, before the deaths of George Floyd and Nicholas Chavez, Houston police beat up a Mexican-American Vietnam veteran and threw him into the bayou. Johnny Mata remembers the case well.
It was early Sunday morning when the news broke.
Joe Torres Jr. lived with his grandmother in the 200 block of Super. He'd recently been discharged from the Army.
It was real surreal because it's just like having a call that one of your family members died in a horrific car crash.
Mata worked with LULAC at the time to try and hold the officers accountable, but a grand jury found the officers guilty of negligent homicide. They got a year's probation and fined $1. It spurred the Moody Park riots.
They convict people for any little bit of thing, any burglary. They convict them for 10 years, 15 years, and here they are trying to get away with murder just because they're cops.
That's Joe Campos Torres' mother, Margaret Torres, talking to KHOU in 1978.
If you would have been a Mexican-American doing this, took up, he would have been on death row.
Mata says what happened then reminds him of the Nicolas Chavez case today. In April, Houston police shot Chavez 24 times after he experienced a mental health crisis.
When you're in the trenches for a long time, you get tired of seeing grieving mothers and fathers and children or whatever. And you kind of say, how do I stop the bleeding?
Mata is 83 years old and has spent more than half of his life fighting for civil rights, especially against police brutality. A young woman molested by police, an innocent man shot and killed in his home. He's learned the ins and outs of the criminal justice system, despite never attending college.
In a lifetime of civil rights, you don't become an expert. You become very knowledgeable.
He grew up in Houston's Second Ward. His mom died when he was young, and his father raised him. As a kid, he worked as a busboy, selling newspapers, and at a tailor shop. That kept him from pursuing higher education. He got his GED when he served in the military during the Cold War and Vietnam War era. When he returned to Houston, he started community work, trying to connect people to jobs.
So I would interview people, and then I would go and see what their needs was, and then I would go to the corporate and small business, depending on the needs.
Later on, Mata joined LULAC and has served several years as both a state and local director. He currently heads the Greater Houston Coalition for Justice. Mata's advocacy helped reform the grand jury process. In the old system, judge-appointed commissioners would hand-pick their jurors. Now, they're chosen randomly, eliminating the chance of conflicts of interest.
This March for Justice is more than the young man that died. Is how do you change the system through those cases?
Now, he's a special advisor to Houston's newly created police reform task force. He hopes the old guard, like him, can work with a new crop of leaders.
You always have to be aware. Bring people up with you. So when you're gone, it was not about your legacy. It's about what did you really accomplish?
In Houston, I'm Elizabeth Trovall.
Support for Coverage of Business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with essential workers who are out there working safe and keeping Texas strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. The energy sector has been hurting this year, but a new survey from the Dallas Fed says things may be stabilizing a bit. This after a major blow from the pandemic and more recently an abnormally active hurricane season. From storms to surveys to solar, when we want to learn the latest goings-on in the energy industry, we turn to insider Matt Smith, Director of Commodity Research at Clipper Data. Matt, welcome back.
Thank you, David.
Well, before we get to this Fed survey, let's check in real quick on the state of things after the past couple of weeks of rather active storm activity. Seems like the worst is behind us, if I look at the calendar and all of that. But what do you see? Better days ahead when it comes to hurricane season or no?
So the good news is that the coast is clear for now. There's no tropical activity in the Atlantic and nothing expected for the foreseeable. But while we still could see further storms forming in the next few weeks, tropical activity really should start dropping off sharply as we get into the latter half of October. So that's the good side of things. All that said, energy infrastructure is still being impacted, particularly by Laura and Marco that happened back in August, as opposed to last week's tropical storm Beta. So we've got operations that are still trying to restart at Lake Charles refineries. They're still suffering from power outages there. And we've also got the Cameron LNG terminal in the same area, which is struggling with the same issue.
That's remarkable. Well, I want to turn to the new Dallas Fed Energy Survey that's out this week. Anything stand out to you? I mean, what topics did it hit on? And I wonder if there's anything that you ran your highlighter over.
Sure. There are a few really good nuggets in this survey, David. Of these all companies surveyed, they got to choose what was their kind of primary goal. And it was maintaining production as opposed to reducing costs or reducing debt. And so I think what we can gather from that is that the cost-cutting element of these businesses has already been done. So now they're shifting their focus to business activity and to keeping cash flow coming through as much as possible. So that was one interesting thing. Another one, and this is kind of crazy, was that 91% of respondents expected it would take an oil price of $50 or higher for a substantial increase in the US oil rig count. So these guys are saying that they need a price 25% higher than where we are now to see drilling activity really increasing. And so from the US production side of things, that isn't particularly positive. And a final nugget really that endorses that was that two-thirds of all of those surveyed believe that US production has peaked, so expecting that we'll never get close to that 13 million barrel a day mark ever again.
That sounds pretty grim, especially if you're hoping for Texas to sort of return to its heyday in oil production, because it sounds like the prices wouldn't really support it if you're in the $40 range right now and you have a lot of your production way below its potential.
Yeah, so it seems these guys are just kind of running as hard as they can to keep production at a similar level to where we are now, as opposed to increasing it by any means.
Finally, on the renewable front, we've been hearing a whole lot about wind power here in Texas of late. Mm-hmm. What about solar? I mean, we've got a lot of sun here, too.
Yes. Well, wind power is doing great. So ERCOT, the manager of the Texas electric grid, sees as much wind power capacity being added in 2020 as it has seen in the last 5 years combined. So wind is doing great. But at the same time, solar is no slouch. The ERCOT interconnection queue, which is essentially planned power capacity, is dominated by solar. So even though not all of the planned capacity will come to market, the amount of planned solar capacity is three times that of the next energy source, which is wind. So while wind has been this growing source over the last few years, looking ahead, solar is going to be catching up with it.
Boy, it's going to be interesting to think about wildcatters in the wind power and solar business. That, I guess, it could happen. Matt Smith is Director of Commodity Research at Clipper Data, and he'll be letting us know if it does. Matt, thanks again.
Thank you.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Texans have 1 week left to register to vote for the November general election. Eligible citizens can submit applications to their county voter registrar's office. Mailed applications must be postmarked by October 5th. Anyone can check the registration status online at votetexas.org. In-person early voting in Texas begins October 13th. Governor Greg Abbott says Texas will set aside $167 million to help people struggling to pay their rent during the pandemic. Another $4 million will fund an eviction diversion program. KERA's Christopher Conley reports.
Funding for the program comes from the federal pandemic aid package passed by Congress in March. Texas still needs federal approval before it can get the money into the hands of stressed-out renters, and that could take until December or longer. For months, housing advocates and landlords have been warning of a looming tidal wave of evictions. Nearly 900,000 Texas renters reported being behind on rent at the beginning of September, according to the Census Bureau, and more than 1.5 million Texans are concerned about paying rent in October. Early this month, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention issued a nationwide eviction moratorium that's active through the end of the year. The public health order covers most renters who earn less than $99,000 a year. I'm Christopher Connolly in Dallas.
U.S. House Democrats say they plan to continue investigating conditions at an immigrant detention center in Georgia. A congressional delegation visited the facility Saturday. They were prompted by a whistleblower complaint that alleged immigrant women there were subjected to medical procedures without their consent, including hysterectomies. San Antonio Congressman Joaquin Castro was among the lawmakers who made the trip. In a video on Twitter, he described meeting a 22-year-old Jocelyn Hernandez, who has been detained for the last month.
She said that, for example, they gave her used underwear when she got here that she's seen so many women who have asked for medications and not gotten them.
Also on the oversight trip were Houston Congresswomen Sylvia Garcia and Sheila Jackson Lee. The Dallas Stars are preparing for Game 6 against the Tampa Bay Lightning in the Stanley Cup Final tonight after avoiding elimination Saturday. Following the double overtime win, the Stars' Tyler Seguin said they don't mind being considered the underdogs.
You know, every person, really this whole time, have been in the bubble, seeming to, you know, choose the other team we're playing. We relish that.
The faceoff starts at 7.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from the Texas Secretary of State, providing voters details on which approved forms of photo ID they can take to the polls. More at votetexas.gov or 800-252-VOTE.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. As the clock ticks down to Election Day 2020, a topic familiar to most Texans continues to come up. What is the impact going to be of the Latino vote? Consider that phrase for just a moment, Latino vote. A rather broad brush for a group of people with many backgrounds, personal histories, ideologies, and interests, wouldn't you say? Benjamin Francis Fallon suggests the history of this concept of the Latino vote may tell us a lot about what the Latino vote actually is, what it is not, and what it means for our future. He is Associate Professor of History at Western Carolina University and author of the new book, The Rise of the Latino Vote, A History. Professor, welcome to the Texas Standard.
And thank you so much for having me.
You make a clear point in your book to emphasize how the Latino vote is not a monolith. And obviously, it's talked about in so many contexts. How did that idea come about? I think a lot of people point back to the election year of 1960. Would you?
I think the election of 1960 was a really important moment in the beginning of what we now kind of recognize as being, you know, the Latino vote. So this was Kennedy against Nixon. And in this moment, Mexican-American activists formed themselves into a kind of a meaningful parallel campaign, which was known as Viva Kennedy. And at certain points in that campaign, the Mexican-American constituency became connected, at least on a surface level, with Puerto Rican constituents. And so that was kind of one of the early moments in which national campaigns began to validate this idea of a nationwide Latino constituency.
In fact, I think many people have probably seen the TV ad that Jacqueline Kennedy cut, specifically in Spanish, trying to appeal to that umbrella group of voters. But as you point out, you know, you have Puerto Rican constituents, Cuban emigres, you have people from Mexico and Latin America, and not all of these ideas really fit under one umbrella, or do they? What about this idea of Unidos?
Well, one of the sort of great statements of this, or most telling statements of this, came during the Nixon administration when analysts were trying to figure out, they were being approached by different Latino leaders who wanted to have representation in government. And by that point, by the early 1970s, they recognized that although these groups, members of these groups, saw themselves as being very different, they saw that for whatever reasons the society saw them as substantially similar enough that they were bound together and that they might as well kind of make the most of it. And so really ever since the early 70s and maybe even a little bit the late 60s, basically the society's reluctance to spend any time differentiating among Latinos came to be something that Latinos tried to turn into a positive by mobilizing their forces for unity. And to certain degrees, it's been successful. There have been a number of important institutions established, the Congressional Hispanic Caucus, among others, that trade on the idea that there's a fundamental unity needed among Hispanic Americans, Latino Americans. So, you know, if for better or worse, for more empowerment or less, the idea has become institutionalized and kind of taken on a life of its own.
What does the history, as you have explored it, have to say about political power as we move into this general election?
So in the present moment, we often see a lot of hand-wringing on the part of liberals and lefties about how is it that Latinos could be supporting Donald Trump after all that he's said about immigration and everything else. But it's clear that for decades, and I talk about this in the book, Republicans made strong efforts to cultivate an enduring Latino constituency. So, you know, there's always all this talk about Democrats shouldn't take Latinos for granted, but Republicans have been doing work in that respect too. So, you know, this notion that Latinos need to rise up as one, otherwise their political actions are a failure, really ignores the complexities of how Latinos have tried to operate politically and also how the major parties have tried to incorporate and in some cases co-opt them. I think one of the other lessons that I try to talk about in the book is that trying to form a national coalition of people from such distinct backgrounds and from such generally weak political positions has in fact opened the door to kind of a manipulation of the constituency by forces that would rather see it disempowered, fractured, who would elevate certain groups in it above others rather than sort of allow it to achieve any form of coherence. So the basic assumption that Latinos are here to save your American democracy from Donald Trump is not one that anybody should be entertaining. It's not fair. It's not historically appropriate. It's just not right.
This is an enormous subject and of huge importance to Texans. And we're going to continue the conversation over at texasstandard.org, but we're out of time on the broadcast. Benjamin Francis Fallon is Associate Professor of History at Western Carolina University and the author of the book, The Rise of the Latino Vote, A History. Professor, thanks so much for spending some time with us on the Texas Standard.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, where faculty do research for the greater good. Like biology professor Dean Williams, who uses genetic mapping to help save horned lizards from extinction. More at tcu.edu/conservation. Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, presenting the Intersect Ed podcast, where the stories of Texas public education policy and practice meet. Available at raiseyourhandtexas.org/podcast and most podcast platforms.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. One challenge the media has faced since its inception is the lack of diversity in prominent voices. But it wasn't until the hashtag OscarsSoWhite started trending that organizations like Public Media started looking inwardly and recognizing that the voices on the air did not reflect the community at large. And yet, for 50 years, when there were few to no other black voices on the radio, there was a space for black voices on the dial, called In Black America, and it came from right here in the heart of Texas. The show is celebrating its golden anniversary this month, and the man at the helm of it for the last 40 years is speaking with us today. John L. Hansen, Jr., host of In Black America. Welcome to Texas Standard.
Well, thank you, David. Thanks for having me on the program.
This program was especially attractive because a lot of celebrities appeared on In Black America over the years, right?
Correct. Well, in the beginning, the program was basically UT-based. Most of the guests were either lecturers on campus or they came to campus to give lectures. So it was really In Black Austin instead of In Black America. And when I was approached to do the program, I suggested that if it's going to be In Black America, then it actually needs to reflect America. The very first interview I had was with Yolanda King, the eldest daughter of Dr. Martin Luther King. And through the years after her was Charlie Pride, then I had Tony Brown, Barbara Jordan, the Commodores, Julius Erving, Jesse Hill, Jesse Jackson, and I could just go on and on and on and on and on.
These are a lot of names that, I mean, just stunning a collection of names and people who don't often appear in mainstream media as well. Do you think they saw In Black America, surely they must have, as a kind of a window, an opportunity for them to have a voice?
I think they did because, as you alluded to earlier, there were very few avenues for African-Americans to express their thoughts and aspirations. And they wanted to be a part of what we're doing.
What about challenges that you faced?
Well, the only challenge is, it's a two-man band, myself and David Alvarez.
David Alvarez, for the record, he's a longtime technical director for the show.
Yeah. Think that whatever happened that week, I had, to be the ringmaster, the researcher, the scheduler and everything. So
didn't have a lot of resources is what it sounds like.
I knew that going in and, I worked with what I had.
What's striking, of course, is that there were no other voices of color, certainly no others that lasted 40 or 50 years on public radio. I think you've set a lot of records over that tenure. Why not? What do you think explains that?
I think the commitment to whatever station that was, you know, in the consortium. A lot of stations, rightly or wrongly, think that Spotlight, as far as African-Americans are concerned, can be included in the other program, which is not necessarily the case. Then you're talking about not a steady 52 weeks a year type of focus. In that sense, you know, a lot of stations, in my opinion, were, you know, short-sighted and not actually having a program. And if they did, it didn't last that long because of other restraint. You know, when it comes time to cut the budget, well, we can cut the African-American program and we can kind of incorporate it into another program. Yeah, you can, but then you shouldn't.
Could you say a little bit more about a point that you were just making? You were saying that, yes, you had people of color who were appearing on other sort of broader news programs, like All Things Considered or Morning Edition, something like that. But you're saying that having a purposeful space, could you articulate or explain why it was important to have that space on the dial?
Well, I think it was important because, I mean, you still had stereotypes and you still had news organizations, for whatever reasons, didn't put the most positive light according to African Americans. Let me just back up. In Black America, wouldn't necessarily be necessary, to coin a phrase, if major media address the African-American experience in a positive and consistent way, which it doesn't. So that's why the program is necessary, because people get a screwed understanding of what life is like for African-Americans in this country.
So as the nation has received quite a wake-up call, certainly over the summer, how have you approached this moment in Black America?
I don't do anything different. What has changed to a certain extent is that the focus has become more intense. These type of incidents have been going on, you know, for decades. I remember reading something that Will Smith has said, you know, this is nothing new. The only thing that's new is that it's being videotaped. And now America gets to actually see a window into what particularly African-American males have been facing for, you know, decades. So I can say, I guess, the cat is out the bag.
You're still going strong with In Black America, and the show's still going strong. I guess for you, as for everyone, there will be a time when you'll decide to step down. And I'm curious, what do you see as the future of the show upon that eventuality? And how do you hope to be remembered?
It's surprising that you asked that question. I had that conversation with our new general manager. And I'm saying maybe 5 years from now, within the next 2 or 3 years, to bring someone on board, and hopefully that individual that can take up the mantle and move the program forward. For myself, it's been a labor of love. All I am trying to do is to bring a voice to the voiceless, and you know what we do is significant. And that significance should be recognized.
Mr. Hansen, how did you get started in radio in the first place?
When I was a young tyke with hair, back in high school, we had a talent show. And I devised a poem for the three-act segments. And after the talent show, a program director at a local radio station came up and asked, had I considered becoming a disc jockey? And I said, no, but I would. I went to work at the radio station. And then from there, I had to go to college in Austin at Houston-Tulsa University now. And then I got a job in school at a station in Lockhart, Texas. And then 3-4 years later, I began working at KUT. And I guess they say the rest is history.
And the rest is history indeed. John L. Hansen Jr. is the longtime host of the longest running space for Black voices on public radio in Black America, celebrating its golden anniversary this year. John, thanks so much for taking time to speak with us on the Texas Standard. It's been a real honor and privilege to have you.
Well, thank you, David, for having me, and you be safe out there.
You too.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund. For over 10 years, helping families lock in current tuition rates and required fees at Texas public colleges and universities, excluding medical and dental institutions. TexasTuitionPromiseFund.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from Galveston Island, welcoming visitors back to the historic beach town while keeping safety in mind. Shopping, Gulf seafood, and family attractions like Moody Gardens and more. Details at Galveston.com.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. When did COVID-19 first arrive in Texas? A new investigative report by the Houston Chronicle raises many questions about how the pandemic has played out of the Lone Star State, including what officials knew and when the wheels started rolling to do something about it. Mike Morris is a local government reporter with the Houston Chronicle, and he, along with a team of Chronicle reporters, have been investigating the official responses to COVID-19 since March, and he joins us now. Mike, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you for having me.
Well, the first part of this investigation, which is out right now, looks into whether COVID-19 was spreading in the Houston area before they even shut down the Houston rodeo. Why did you want to focus on the rodeo, and what did you find?
Well, any examination of the pandemic in Houston has to start with the rodeo closure on March 11th, which was obviously before its full run, about halfway through, because really that's the moment in time when local residents were kind of startled into recognizing the virus's threat. Prior to that time, there had been no local gathering closures or anything like that. This was the, you know, it's the city's biggest event. It's the biggest kind of cultural gathering, concerts, carnivals. It's not just bull riding. The decision to close that early really woke everybody up locally to the fact that this was going to be a problem we would face here.
Is it clear whether it was an actual vector for spread of the disease? And what, tell us a little bit about the reluctance to shut it down.
It's not entirely clear how many people got sick from attending rodeo events, because local public health departments didn't have a rigid protocol for determining which of their patients had attended a mass gathering of some kind. But Harris County epidemiologists later determined that 12 people who had eventually tested positive had been to some kind of rodeo event. And it was the first case of community spread dated back to the pre-rodeo barbecue cook-off in late February. There is certainly some number of people who public officials believe did get sick at rodeo events. I mean, the reluctance to shut it down really stems from the fact that it is the region's largest event and generates all sorts of economic impact for the region. Tons of students, kids put a bunch of work into preparing to show their animals. I mean, there were all sorts of factors. There were some people behind the scenes who pointed out that the kind of textbook approach of waiting for a confirmed case of community spread might not make sense in this case, because testing was inadequate at that time, and that was fairly well understood, but it remains something that people had trouble acting on. And in retrospect, they were somewhat lucky, I guess, that a confirmed case of community spread was among the first dozen or so cases in our area.
Well, I want to find out, though, what this says in a larger sense about officials' reaction, because this is obviously, this sort of thing unfolded in different ways across the Lone Star State. And I'm wondering, as you look at the way that officials were trying to grasp the size and scope of this pandemic, what the impact might be without having a whole lot of guideposts here, not knowing which official to contact and who actually had authority to shut it down. It what does this say about the way that officials have handled this case overall, the pandemic, I mean?
Yeah, I think it goes to the lack of information. I mean, the lack of information and guidance from the CDC. The local officials made the decision to shut the rodeo days before the CDC issued any sort of guidance about mass gatherings. There's a lack of information from a lack of testing that was driven by the CDC's decision not to use the WHO tests for coronavirus and try to come up with their own, and then bungle that attempt, leaving too few to go around, which meant there wasn't sufficient testing as the rodeo got underway to determine who might have the virus in the Houston region. I do think that lack of information, to be charitable, it was a new virus that was poorly understood and is still not all that well understood. But yeah, I mean, I think people operating in the dark is really the main takeaway.
Mike Morris is a local government reporter with the Houston Chronicle. He's part of a team of reporters that have been investigating Harris County and the state's overall response to the COVID-19 pandemic. This series of stories is rolling out across the week, and we're going to have a link to the latest over at texasstandard.org. Mike, thanks again.
Yeah, thank you.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Wells Dunbar is monitoring what Texans are talking about on this Monday. Hello again, Wells.
Howdy, David. Good to hear from you. And we are hearing from our friends and listeners about a bunch of the news out there. The big news story that broke over this weekend, this blockbuster report from the New York Times, where they appear to have gotten their hands on President Donald Trump's tax returns, some 18 years, and some pretty stunning findings, writing that in 11 of those 18 years, the President Donald Trump paid no income tax at all. The year he entered the White House, he only paid $750. In taxes. This is due to deductions for just a breathtaking amount of losses, business losses in the millions that he was able to deduct. So lots to pour over there and lots of takes coming in about all this stuff. On our Facebook page, Keith Vasek says this about taxes. As a lower level government worker, I pay a good chunk of my salary in taxes. We all know that corporations and the wealthy, because of tax dodges and loopholes, usually pay very little into the national purse. But to see the actual number, $750, was infuriating. Somehow, $750 was worse than zero, he writes. I just imagine his accountants couldn't find enough loopholes. Last year, at about a tenth of his presidential salary, I paid almost 10 times what Trump did in taxes. And this comment as well from Irma Garcia, interesting perspective here on one of the headlines that came out of that report, a food for thought. Trump wrote off $70,000 to have his hair styled, while teachers are allowed a maximum $200 tax credit for the purchase of school supplies. $70,000 is less than most teachers are paid, and they have to use their own money to furnish supplies for their classrooms. More than infuriating. And that report, that $70,000 deduction, while in fact was used as a deduction while he was hosting The Apprentice, so deducting that on his business taxes there. Very remarkable story, remarkable series of reports there.
It is. MarketWatch has an interesting sort of follow-up. Who pays no federal tax? And apparently they found 75 million Americans pay no federal tax. 43.3% of tax filing households don't pay any. This according to the Urban Institute and the Brookings Institution, those Washington-based think tanks. One of the interesting quotes in that article was that this isn't a bug in the tax code. It's the way the tax code is made. I suppose we should point out an important caveat here. People who don't pay any federal income tax still pay sales tax and property taxes and other taxes like that. But I think a lot of people infuriated by what they read in the New York Times report over the weekend, that's for sure.
Yeah, lots of ways to go with this. Definitely so, David.
Yeah. We're out of time for the big broadcast, but the news continues over at texasstandard.org, and we hope you'll visit us there and keep us posted with what's making news in your part of Texas, as always. We'll be back here tomorrow, and we hope you'll join us. Till then, I'm David Brown, along with Wells Dunbar and the rest of the Texas Standard crew, wishing you a marvelous Monday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Woldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington family.